It's Saturday, August 11th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. In the first half of Geek Speak, we will cover geek news. In the second half, your calls and commentaries on the week in geek. It is time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Al Luckow. And as always, our theme song is, or at least most of the time, is Creative Commons, Share and Share Alike. If you want to make up your own theme for Geek Speak, by all means, remix it, send it our way, and we'll take a listen and maybe even play it for the show. Once again, I'm Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie. With me in the air room are Bonnie Jean Primsch, mediator, printmaker, and broadcaster at large.
Only slightly befuddled.
Although she does not look it at all.
Thank you.
Ben Jaffe, web instructor and world traveler.
Quite flummoxed.
Wait, are you on?
Am I on?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, okay.
I'm number three. Can you hear me? In the headphones?
I guess I can. Yeah. And I'm going to start off with a little bit of news. Ben, you want to start?
Also, I wanted to introduce Stacey Juergens.
Oh,
she's
yes.
Also with us, too. A technical trainer and all-around geek.
Welcome, Stacey.
Thank you.
Oh, but she's not up. There. Let's try that again.
Thank you very much.
Ooh, board issues. Okay, so, I want to talk about Curiosity because...
Curiosity being...
That which killed the cat. No, the
and leader... hopefully won't kill whatever life really is on Mars.
Yes.
I actually saw a wonderful image about that. That was Curiosity with a cat run over his treads. Curiosity killed the cat.
Okay, so for those of you who are lost by our jokes, Curiosity is the new Mars rover. We've sent three rovers, unmanned rovers to Mars to kind of crawl, roll around and everything. This is our fourth. And, it's kind of fantastic. It has six main scientific objectives. The ones I'm most excited about are helping to determine whether Mars could have ever supported life, and also figuring out what the role of water and how the climate and geology of Mars works. So it's going to be a pretty good information-gathering mission. It's got a whole bunch of fantastic gear on it. And also, there's a really great video... This should be in my geek bit, I guess, because it's something you have to see. But there's a really great video called The 7 Minutes of Terror. And it is a video that NASA had
made. It's the horror movie that NASA is releasing.
Right. It's about Curiosity killing the cat. No, it's about the landing sequence of this rover. So there are all of these ridiculously complex steps that have to go exactly right to get this rover down on Mars. And it turned out everything went well and they landed successfully. I saw it live on NASA TV. It was very exciting to see all of the people in the mission control room, you know, jumping up and down and high-fiving each other like they did during the Apollo missions and everything. Also, there's one of the people in the mission control room had pointy ears. They had actually put pointy Aww. Ears on themselves. So they dressed up like
it's
a
adorable.
Vulcan for it. I know. So anyway, he kind of looked like Zachary Quinto, the guy who played Spock in the latest Star Trek movie.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so kind of fantastic.
Or Siler on Heroes.
Exactly. Yeah, God, celebrities.
Just to show the geek cred there.
Yeah, exactly. Although, like, I'd like to think of William Shatner as Captain James D. Kirk as opposed to the guy from those Spriteline.com commercials, you know. But anyway, so a lot of really great information coming back. It's actually started sending images back, and that's really exciting as well.
Wasn't that part of the point?
Well, of course. But I mean, what
it's
I'm
just
saying
nice
is
that it works.
Exactly. We not only successfully landed, right? That was difficult enough, but. Just how horrible would it be if Curiosity landed and then was dead or something. You know, had a kernel panic and didn't do anything. So we're getting really great images back. They're going to be sending high-res images throughout, I believe, next week. They're going to be sending the high-res ones. But yeah, it's really pretty exciting to that we can do something that complex and get such a cool machine to do such cool science on a speck of light up in the sky. You know, that's just awesome to me. So
a speck of reflected light. It's not a light source.
Well, I guess the sun isn't a speck of light either.
Pedantic geek is pedantic.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks. If you want to be pedantic.
And speaking of which, and speaking of complexity, every piece of software has bugs. It's just a simple fact of the matter that in order for a software to not have bugs, software would have to be perfect. And software is written by human beings who are notoriously
completely
imperfect.
Made of meat.
And
made of meat.
Exactly. Right. And not just one person, but several people who may not agree about what is supposed to be expected of a particular piece of code. And so the Mars rover Curiosity actually has a mechanism for upgrading its software.
Is it? It's Windows Update. It goes to update.windows.com.
But at the same time, we're talking about updating software from 350 million miles away. This is not your typical software update for Mac OS X or Windows Update for Windows. So just to let you know, if they can update their software from 350 million miles away,
then why
our
can't
audience,
I get cell phone reception?
Yeah, our audience, our audience can update their software on the laptop sitting in front of them.
Yeah.
It was a note of encouragement.
Yes.
Not a where's my flying car. Okay.
Yeah. It's a lot easier, too.
Yeah, it's not rocket science to update the software in front of you. It's rocket science to update the software 350 million miles away.
Or at least it's rocket scientists doing it. So
yes.
I also have a bit of sad news to go with my happy news, because also, speaking of complexity, you know, just getting something off the ground is hard enough, it turns out, as is demonstrated by our occasional failure stories. So on Thursday, the Morpheus project, it was a low-cost moon and asteroid lander using clean fuels on a shoestring budget, not very much money going into it.
Clean fuels?
I don't have a huge amount of detail about it, because it exploded when they were testing it, like in early test phases.
Did it explode cleanly?
No, it did not. It kind of like blew up into this ball of fire and burned for maybe a minute or two.
Okay, so it was,
and then there was
awesome.
A massive explosion after that. I mean, it's an exciting video to watch, but it's also really sad to think. I mean, if you're one of the people on that working on that mission, you know, if you're one of the people building a scientific instrument for, I don't know, imaging something in a particular situation way later down the mission, and then the mission gets off the ground and explodes in midair on Earth, that's pretty disappointing, I'll bet.
Yes.
So anyway.
Although clean fuel, it sounds odd to me, just because when we think of the space shuttle, the now defunct space shuttle, rest in peace, that fuel source was liquid hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. But it's just massive amounts of it, right?
Yes, but at the same time, fun fact for everyone, when the shuttle took off, in the immediate area, there was a rainstorm because of all the hydrogen put in there oxidized,
really?
Or burned, you create H2O.
That makes sense.
And then you end up with cloud formations, and then you end up with a downpour.
That's crazy. Yeah, I actually, speaking of clean fuels, I hear the project lead is named Zephram Cochrane, and I think it's the precursor to the warp drive, I think it is.
Oh, okay.
None of that is true. That's all a Star Trek joke. Sorry.
However, I do have to say that the fuel that is used that was used by the shuttle and other vehicles outside the Earth's atmosphere was not clean.
Yeah.
That was stuff that, well, there's not that much oxygen out there in space, so burning that would be kind of complicated. And then if you took the oxygen up, that means a whole other payload you have to bring up, and then you also have dissipation issues in space. And you need to, when you want to fire that rocket in space, you want it to fire.
Yeah.
You don't want you don't. There's no Jiffy Lube to go check out.
You
know, right.
Up in orbit. So what? So you need, how do you? What do you burn then?
I'm trying to wonder if they use hydrazine or if they're. But I've forgotten the name of it. But it's offhand. But it's a very caustic, toxic chemical. That the idea is you're bringing two chemicals together. That are so. I mean, that are. When they come together, they will immediately have a violent reaction. Mm-hmm. Okay. Where there's no choice about it. There's no, okay, you're trying to get a spark going with your lighter or something like that. Yeah. It's if they go together, it goes. Yeah. If they don't go together, they don't go.
Yeah, which means the whole mission doesn't go.
But at the same time, those were not clean material. Those are not materials you want spread around.
Right.
Well, luckily, space is not particularly hospitable to life. So, you know, I guess worrying about the environmental impacts of said chemicals. Well, what environment? I don't know.
On the contrary, I was thinking about when rockets explode.
Ah, yeah,
before they reach orbit.
Oh, of course, of course. In those situations, not so good.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, so good news, bad news. But I mean, the good news is that the ridiculously complex mission that was on its way to Mars for years landed safely. And the bad news isn't nearly as bad, which is the rocket and the system that they were testing here on Earth that wasn't close to launching, that exploded, you know? So I don't know. But, you know, you have your successes, you have your failures and everything, and I guess you roll with it. But it's kind of cool having another rover on Mars.
The Mars mission was far more expensive as well.
Oh, yes. That's so true, too. And
$2.5 billion, I last heard.
I don't know the figure, but it's a lot of money.
But I mean,
it's
a much larger rover than it was before. Mm-hmm. The whole sky crane thing.
So
have you heard about
this? Complicated. Well, what was it? Here's my totally layperson read half of a headline understanding is that once. Our little mission was a certain amount of away from the surface of the planet. Mm-hmm. It shot down a little, like a zip line or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
It had retro rockets, so it was a sky crane that was remaining aloft while it lowered the rover down to the surface.
Yeah.
And so it was hovering with rockets above the surface of Mars. And the reason it was doing that instead of just touching down with rockets like you would see in a sci-fi movie is because it would kick up so much dust that all of the dust would land on the rover, mess up all the instruments, and then you wouldn't be able to get any, you know,
or you would be burning up the samples that you might want to take when you first landed.
That's another thing too,
and contaminating that data source.
Did it have anything to do with like the last Mars mission just plummeting right into the surface of the planet?
The last Mars mission did a little bouncy thing. Inflated
the last successful one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the last successful one, they inflated
a couple of drag sheets that broke off, and then you ended up with what amount to large airbags surrounding it that, you know, bounced it around on the surface.
Yeah. It kind of acted like a bouncy ball and eventually came to rest. And then luckily unfolded in a way that it could roll off of the platform. It's so crazy. Anyway, the way it's described in that video that I mentioned, 7 Minutes of Terror video, is Mars has an unfortunate amount of atmosphere. It has just enough atmosphere that you have to deal with it because otherwise you'll burn up in it. But it doesn't have enough atmosphere to slow the payload down to a very slow speed because it's relatively thin. You know, whereas here on Earth, you can slow down to, I don't know what it is, 40 or 50 miles per hour.
Faster than that for terminal velocity.
With a parachute. They can get it down to 20 or 30.
If you have a big enough parachute, you can go slower than that.
Yeah, but like when the Apollo missions were coming in, they had these huge parachutes, and they slowed it down to a relatively low velocity, and then they crashed into the water, and that got them the rest of the way. But with Mars, you know, there's just not enough atmosphere to slow it down very much at all. So you don't want to plummet into the surface, but you need the parachutes and all that stuff to not burn up in the atmosphere. So anyway, it's madness. Not a very hospitable planet.
I saw that the whole Curiosity landing thing was called sort of a Rube Goldbergian solution, which actually worked.
Yeah. So was the original moon landing. I mean, the idea of you fire off a rocket and then you send something into orbit around the moon. And then from the moon, you drop something off. And then portion of that remains on the moon as you lift off to meet the thing in moon orbit again to dock and then come back. Oh, yeah. As you switch vehicles.
But I guess what else would you do? You know, you use up a bunch of fuel, well, and then you've got these huge fuel tanks. You know, same thing happens when you're...
It was the only, I mean, it was the most efficient way they could get it done.
Yeah.
But at the same time...
It's kind of, yeah, I don't know.
10 points for Rube Goldberg machines.
Yeah, what was the estimate for docking in orbit, just around the Earth, like firing something up and docking around orbit? It's kind of like two people in opposite yards trying to shoot a bullet and... At the same time and hitting at the same time.
Yeah.
Meeting in the middle.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know. I have issues with those metaphors just because I guess it explains it to the public how it's ridiculously complicated. But at the same time, it's not that the chances are that low. You know, like,
if you have a precise enough gun, then yeah.
Exactly. So they just have to build really precise guns in that case, going with the metaphor. Anyway.
Right. But to make it clear to folks, I want you to imagine how large, at least to us, the Earth's surface is. Like, how long it would take to walk around, assuming that, like, you had ground to walk on along the ocean. You know, or you... If you've gotten a small, you know, skipper boat and just...
Are you saying it would take a long, long time to walk the whole thing, Miles?
Yes, it would take quite a bit of time. And then think, we're talking about in orbit, so which means that sphere has become much larger. Even though we're not that far off the surface to get into orbit, I guess you are somewhat, but I mean, but if you're going fast enough, you can stay in orbit. If you just get past the atmosphere, and the atmosphere doesn't raise that far off the surface, relatively speaking to the size of the Earth.
I'm lost. But we can say it's super, super difficult. And,
but I mean,
you know.
that notion of like getting two things, imagine getting two things, like trying to get them to collide on the Earth's surface, mm-hmm. and how much surface there is to catch in there. Once you get out into orbit,
it's even more.
There's even more space in space.
It's even harder.
Much more harder.
I don't know. I'm not too convinced that any of the metaphors quite work because I don't know. There are a number of reasons. Like, you know, you can make adjustments as you're going along, whereas once you fire the bullet, in our little bullet metaphor, you can't make adjustments.
On the contrary,
the army
is working on bullets that
smart bullets
that will actually change their.
Well, we're not talking about... Well, okay, so when you say to a layman, you fire two bullets at each other, they don't think, oh, well, I guess you could make those really smart bullets with microprocessors and small rockets. I mean, like, in that case, you may as well just say it's just as difficult as trying to get two things to rendezvous in space, which is exactly what we're talking about. So the metaphor doesn't quite work anymore. But anyway, I don't know. So we've been talking about space too long.
Yeah, so what's your next topic?
We're a bit out there. Me?
Yes.
Oh, no, someone else. Does anyone else have, or do you, Stacey,
why don't you start talking about hacking?
Oh, so, okay,
We'll take it back down to the Earth. And
I was back down to the Earth. So, yeah, I was trying to work on some of the equations for my own space probe, right? And I needed a place to hack.
Like you do.
I needed a place to hang out and hack with a bunch of really cool people who could help me with my, I don't have... great math skills. I love calculus, but I get all the numbers wrong. I'm bad at algebra. So I needed some people to hack with, and I found this cool place called the Hacker Dojo. But as it turns out, the Hacker Dojo is in trouble. I can't remember the rest of the story. Hey, Stacey, do you want to talk about it?
Why, yes, I would.
First of all, what is this Hacker Dojo you speak of?
Yeah, what is a Hacker Dojo?
The Hacker Dojo is a fantastic space. It's in Mountain View on Wisman Road. And it's a creative space and a community where people can get together and hack on things, whether it be programming or... Oh, that sounds better. Whether it be programming or building things. Painting the walls, whatever people want to work on or hack on.
They have equipment there too, right?
They have lots of equipment.
Yeah.
Soldering irons, sewing machines, you name it. Anything you need, for the most part, anything that you need to work on something, they either have it available or if you let them know, they'll make it available.
So speaking of Rube Goldberg machines, if you want to make one, then they got the tools for you.
It probably. depending on your equipment.
To build the better mousetrap.
Yeah. So the Hacker Dojo is a fantastic space. I've been on and off involved with it this entire year. And I love the space. And the people there are fantastic. And for example, I went there once for an event. And I was working on a website. And there was this one part where I was really, really stuck. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to solve this problem. And I happened to turn to the person who was sitting next to me. And I said, hey, do you know blah, blah, blah? And he said, why, yes, I do. I was working on PHP at the time. And I said, you know, I said, hey, do you know PHP? And he says, yes, I do. And so the two of us sit down for about 20 minutes and we work through this gigantic bug together. And suddenly my website worked and I was super excited. So at that point in time, I was completely hooked. You know, there's people that they help each other out all the time. And it's just a really fantastic community and I love it a lot. But as Ben mentioned, they are having a little bit of an issue at this time. The city of Mountain View has given them a conditional use permit, which at this point is capping their events currently at 49 attendees. Now, they have this gigantic, huge space, and they like to host you know, events and workshops and educational events and things of that nature, which is, of course, of interest to me in particular as a technical trainer and educator. I would love to use the space for that purpose, but capping 49 attendees makes it really difficult, especially since
big space.
It's
a
really thousands of square feet. Or why is 49 the cap?
The reason is because they need to upgrade their bathrooms to be ADA compatible, and they also need to upgrade their fire sprinkler suppression system. So the city of Mountain View is wanting them to complete all of the renovations for that by the end of December. I think December, 27th is their deadline. And so they have estimated that it takes about $250,000 to do that. And they have currently raised, let me see, where are my numbers? They have currently raised $132,000 with general fundraisers, and they have raised $24,000 on their Kickstarter, which you can access by going to hackerdojo.com/Kickstarter. But there's also an auction, which I'm a part of. It's really awesome. There's this website that's pairing with them called Goodwillian. And for the entirety of August, any auctions that are hosted on Goodwillian are, it's a place where you can auction off your time in exchange for money that goes to a good cause. And for all of August, all money raised is going to the Hacker Dojo. And I'm auctioning off my own custom lecture. And there's, oh God, there's some really awesome people there. Like, for example, who do we have? Don McAskill. He's the CEO and chief geek at SmugMug. He's auctioning off his time. David Weekly started PB Wiki, Hacker Dojo, Super Happy Dev House, etc. He's auctioning off his time. There's
so people are offering their services as a donation,
yes,
and then people pay mm-hmm. money for their time, but the money goes toward
the Hacker Dojo.
Yeah, there's actually something in the SLV called timeshares, timesharing, mm-hmm. Where people are giving their time, although it's not necessarily computer related. So it's really nice to hear it's also yeah. like getting to the computer field.
Well, for example, there's one woman who's going to be making a cake. She's a caterer. She's making this mm-hmm. fantastic cake. There's somebody that's making 5 gallons of custom beer. It's all these people mm-hmm. who have they like to make things or hack on things. I mean, some of it is definitely computer related. There's lots of people offering advice for if you have a startup and you need some advice on how to make it work, if you need to look at your business plan, whatever of that nature. But people who have skills that aren't necessarily Hacker Dojo related or Kickstarter related, they want to offer their time. And so it's a great space to do that.
I love this out of the box mentality. You know, like most companies would say, hey, we need money. Can you donate? Blah, 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 blah. But I love the idea of if you don't have money to donate, but maybe you have skills and maybe, like, for example, I enjoy teaching web development sometimes, I guess, not too much of it, right? I'm kind of burned out at the end of a long summer of teaching, right? But generally, I enjoy teaching web development or visual effects with After Effects or something like that, right? And so instead of giving money, I could give some time and I could do something that I would enjoy doing while also helping to benefit a cause. So I think in general, that website, Goodwillian, is a pretty cool website as well. To check out, as well as, of course, the Hacker Dojo being an awesome hack space. And yeah, I don't know. They also host a lot of events for the community that you don't necessarily have to pay to go to. And I think that's great.
Happy hour on Friday.
Happy hour on Friday, yeah.
And with that, I believe we should hit our midway point.
Welcome to the midway point of GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Small Business Tech specializes in protecting data and has been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com.
You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And we will be taking your calls now. Rick Philman is listening in, ready for you. The numbers are 1-800-655-5877. Or if you're local in the 831 area code or nearby, 831-476-2800.
Hey, Miles.
Yes.
I got a geek bit.
Oh, hey. Go for it.
All right. So for any of you guys who are interested in watching meteor showers, there is a meteor shower going on currently, right now.
Run for your lives. Oh, my God. We're all gonna die.
It's Armageddon, except they're really, really small.
Oh, okay.
I know it must be the Perseids because it's foggy out.
It is, or Perseids. I never know how to pronounce it. I always write it down to pronounce it correctly. It is Perseids, right? Miles, he's the person to ask, I think.
Okay, Perseids.
Because he'll correct you if you're wrong. Okay, cool. I'm not sure, and he nods his head. Okay, so anyway, that's kind of fantastic. The peak is on the night around August 12th. That's tomorrow. So that means tonight, tomorrow night, and Monday night, the 11th through the 13th, it's going to be the best meteor shower of the year in terms of how many and how bright and everything. And
can people expect to see?
Meteor rates as high as about 100 per hour. So that's almost 2 a minute. So if you're just laying there on the ground,
a lot of wishes.
Looking up, yeah, exactly. get your wishes ready.
You might want to start writing them down just so you can keep track of them all.
So yeah, better than a wishing well. Anyway, kind of fantastic. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, the Perseid meteor shower is when Earth passes through along its orbit around the sun as it passes through a stream of debris from a comet named Swift Tuttle. And this happens pretty much every year. Actually, it happens exactly every year. And you should go check it out because it is the best meteor shower of the year. So if you like shooting stars, then tonight, tomorrow night, and Monday night are the best.
And if you don't like shooting stars,
just
what's wrong with you?
Foggy.
Yeah, right. If any of you guys are really hardcore, the best time to look at the meteor shower is really early in the morning, like 2 a.m. or so, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., before the sun comes up.
Especially where there isn't much light pollution.
Exactly. So San Francisco, not so great. Santa Cruz, not so great. But maybe Santa Cruz Mountains. That's a great place to go. I mean, not a great place, but a better place to go.
Yes.
If you really want to be crazy, you could drive out to the desert. And that's going to be great because of the low humidity and all of that. And hopefully clear skies, you should be able to see some.
Yeah,
really,
you have to say near the summit, you probably wouldn't have that bad a light I'm pollution. Hoping.
Well, if you can see a city, then you're going to get light pollution from
That's
it.
True.
There's also Mount Hamilton.
Mount Hamilton, yeah.
Which is kind of designed for that purpose.
Yes. Yeah, it is. So, yeah.
Not the mountain,
informative
of course.
Geek
but,
is informative.
You've been on Reddit, haven't you?
What?
The meme. Informative geek is informative.
Yeah, whatever.
Annoying geek about. Is annoying. No, I'm kidding.
But it is really cool to see in the middle of the night. I've done that in previous years, gotten up at the crack of dawn and got bundled up in a blanket and gone out on the... It was really awesome to watch.
One last thing is if you do feel inclined to go for a drive, go for a drive for the stars, but then go now because not only do you see incredible stars, if you're out away from light pollution, you see, of course, tons of shooting stars. Woohoo!
Speaking of woohoo, we have a phone call. So why don't we take... Yeah, I'm learning this new board. Hold on.
Yeah, we got a new board. It's pretty intimidating.
Yeah.
There's a lot of buttons.
You got your finger on the wrong slider.
Do I? Oh, yes, I do. There we go. Vickiano?
Yes.
Hi, from Coralitos.
Welcome.
Oh, hello. I had a question. I have a CD player. It's a Microsoft. It's an Office made in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's Mountain Lion. And the CD won't come out of the player. And there's no little teeny button that I could take a pin to push next to it to make it come out.
No emergency hole. That's unusual.
This is a laptop or a desktop?
For a laptop.
It's a laptop.
Is it one of those slot load, or is it like you push the button on the outside and it pops open?
That one I don't know. Let's see. Someone gave it to me and I've never used it.
I know that sometimes...
Well, how would you normally eject, I guess, is the question.
I don't know because I was given the computer and I never it was given me with that situation.
Yeah.
Okay.
The things I would think of are, obviously if there's a button there, try hitting the button when the computer's on, but there probably isn't a button if there's no hole. But also, if you don't see a hole, sometimes along the edges, the seam where it would come out, sometimes there's a little divot, and that's actually the hole. But if
it's
that's...
A little what?
That sometimes, like, along the seam where the DVD tray would come out, sometimes there's a little hole on the edge there, right? That's one possibility. But if there's not one of those, then... can you turn on the computer?
I can't get online either because I'm out in the country and most of the time it doesn't come on.
But will it actually turn on and boot into Windows? Do you know...
Yeah, I can do that.
So another thing you could do is you could try... this is Windows 98, you said?
I think it's 2008.
Okay, so maybe XP or maybe 8 or something. If you can find on the Windows Explorer, if you can find your C drive and your D drive, the various drives, if you can right click on, and this is on the screen, right? If you can right click on the drive itself, you might be able to tell it to eject there.
On the CD drive.
On the CD drive. And this is in the software.
Okay, Windows Explorer, and then would I push?
On the left-hand side, you should see a list of drives.
Okay.
Do you see, like, your hard drive and My Documents and maybe a CD-ROM drive icon?
Okay.
You would right-click on the CD-ROM drive.
Yeah. Another possibility is if you see something that says My Computer, that's another place you could click on that and then see if in the resulting window it pops up with the DVD drive.
And just to be clear, when we say right-click, that's the right mouse button.
Yeah. So,
there's no mouse in this. There's just a rectangular thing.
Yeah, a trackpad. In that case, are there two buttons on the trackpad?
I'm not sure.
Are there buttons below the trackpad?
Oh, wait. If I push this one, I get... And if I push... No. Oh, wow. I'm going to have someone call you.
Yeah, it looks like you need a little bit of help there.
Okay.
So best of luck to you.
If I go... Windows Explorer, and what do I look for?
You would look for an icon that looks like a CD-ROM drive.
Yeah.
Or it may say DVD. And then you would click the right mouse button on it.
DVD or what?
Yeah, look for something that says CD or DVD. It might have the letter D, like D colon or something like that on it, or E colon. One of the difficulties with Windows is with all the different versions of Windows, they kind of change where these things are. Like they're kind of in the same place, but on the left-hand side, you have different shortcuts. And so it's difficult for us to tell you exactly what to click on. But if you poke around and try to find something that says DVD or has a DVD
icon. It should be obviously
icon,
a CD or a DVD
like an icon. Yeah, a little picture.
If it isn't, you'll need some help to track that down.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
And right click.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right click and then eject.
Okay, thank you.
Best of luck to you. It's really tough because I realize people get really frustrated with computers and they're thrust into a situation they're not prepared for.
It's a whole language thing, too. To even describe the stuff you're looking at is difficult.
That's absolutely true, yeah.
And she's running Windows. Oh, sorry.
Obligatory Windows thing.
Yeah, it's like, I'm on a Mac. Oh, see that icon, that button at the top right hand corner of your keyboard? you hit that.
Yeah, it's pretty. That's a little easier. Although these days, they've replaced it with a power button on the.
They're taking it away.
Retinas, yeah. Dag nabbit.
but that's because they don't have CD-ROM drives.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point, so, sir.
What would an eject do if you didn't have a CD-ROM drive?
That's true.
So, our phone lines are free. So, if anyone wants to call in, once again, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And while we're waiting for calls, why don't we cover some more news?
All right. So, have you guys seen the movie Armageddon?
Yes.
That's the asteroid is coming toward the Earth, and I guess Bruce Willis can save us, right?
Wait, which one's that one?
The one with the Aerosmith song, right?
Okay, right?
The one with the Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck.
Wait, did it have Ben Affleck?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know my celebrities. I just know
Bruce
Willis.
He was the young love interest.
He was?
Yes.
Oh. The romantic lead, the chin.
I don't. I don't know.
The hothead who makes good.
So, anyway, doom and gloom, right? An asteroid is hurtling towards Earth. And so they put together some I don't know.
A group of oil drillers.
Yeah. And they drill into the asteroid and they plant a bomb in there and then it explodes and the asteroid barely clear. Wait, I don't want to spoil the movie. But
spoiler alert.
Earth doesn't, it's an old enough movie, right? Earth doesn't get destroyed. In fact, it breaks into two pieces and it splits around the Earth and goes on each side of the Earth with about a clearance of 400 miles. So that sounds, we've got some figures to work with. And so it's a University of Lancaster student.
Just to back up, we've talked about this before on the show, but just to be clear, Armageddon got two things right. Asteroids, in fact, exist. True. And from time to time, they will head toward the planet Earth.
Okay. And that's about all they got right.
That's about all they got right. However, we're going to be very specific about another area that...
Yes. So some students at the University of Leicester. Thank you. I can never pronounce that, that school. Leicester.
Oh, Leicester.
Leicester.
Yeah.
Really? It has an extra C in it.
It's Leicester.
Oh, Worcestershire, you know.
Oh, jeez. Anyway.
UK school, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Leicester.
So they crunched some numbers, and they found out that, yes, indeed, this is possible if, one, we detonate it pretty much as soon as we would detect it, right? Which is not what happened in the movie. It's hurtling towards Earth, and then they put together a team of people, and then they, you know, detonated, I don't know, like 5 minutes before it's going to hit Earth.
Yeah, they detonated, well, it's inside the orbit of the moon, because that's how they got to it. Uh-huh. It was they slingshotted around the moon and came back to it.
Yeah, yeah. So, which actually, so they got close. That kind of right. That's another thing they kind of got right, kind of, maybe a little bit.
That
really
they would have
all.
To go the same...
That
velocity
they would have
direction,
to be facing...
same velocity as the comet or just slightly greater so that they could catch up to it.
Yeah. So it turns out...
Not slam right into it.
If you were to detonate this asteroid, as soon as we would be able to detect it, right? Really, really far away. It is possible, assuming that you had a bomb that was 1 billion times the strength of the biggest bomb on Earth.
Which would have been... The Tsar bomb.
Soviet Union's big Ivan.
Like a 50 megaton bomb.
50, yeah, exactly. 50 megaton hydrogen bomb. If you had a 50 mega billion ton bomb.
Well, 50
billion
50 times.
Mega, 50 billion megatons.
It's 8 billion times, you say?
50 quadrillion ton bomb.
Okay.
Quadrilliton bomb. Is that a word?
It
anyway,
is now.
So anyway, if you had that bomb, then it would be possible. So this is just another... We've talked about Armageddon several times on the show in the last couple of years. This is yet another nail in the coffin saying that this movie is completely unrealistic in every way possible. It's kind of awesome.
So that was our Armageddon bashing moment of the show.
It's true. Well, I mean, the reason that I bring up Armageddon is because they actually took that number where it clears by 400 miles, and they thought, okay, well, if we go by the Armageddon numbers, the numbers that they threw out in Armageddon in the movie, what would have to happen, right? So in any case, yeah, 8 billion miles away, a billion times our biggest bomb, and yeah, that would barely work. Pretty cool.
And the math knows.
And the math. I love the math.
Because, you know, all those folks that memorize pi out to, you know, 1,000 digits or whatever it is. Uh-huh. Six decimal places of pi got us to the moon. Just to give you a case of, like, math works.
So, could you get us to the moon? Do you know enough pi?
Well, I can't. But then again, when you talk about, can a robot... paint a masterpiece. Well, can you?
3.1415926. 3, 4, 5, 6. That's seven digits. I could get it to the moon.
All right. When's the next trip?
Right.
And on that note, we're going to take another call having to do with CD-ROM drives. Hello, Sam from Santa Cruz.
Oh, hi. Hi, Geeks.
Hi.
Welcome.
How are you? so good to hear from you. I'm on the cell phone, so hopefully we'll stay with you. We have a computer that's maybe a couple years old,
mm-hmm.
and it's a Windows 7. And basically, the computer is no longer seeing the DVD drive. We've tried replacing, not taking out the old drive, but adding an external DVD drive, and it doesn't see that either.
Interesting.
So the question is what, and we have tried to upgrade the drivers and everything else. So for some reason, it's still not working.
The only thing I can think off the top of my head, although this would be very unusual, is in Windows services, and we can get into more detail about that later, is there's a Tappy CD-ROM burn. Not CD-ROM burning. That's not actually detecting the drive.
That's a tough one, too.
So you have an external that's connecting through USB?
Well, actually, I bought one, a brand new one, and just to try to thinking that maybe it was the drive itself that was bad.
Right, but how are you connecting it to your computer, I guess, is the question.
Well, I connect it via USB.
Okay.
Correct.
Which means that it's a completely different type of connection as the internal model. And mm-hmm. so you've done very well in that you've taken two very distinct ways of connecting up a CD-ROM drive, and Windows is not.
So you've eliminated a lot of the potential problems.
So it sounds like the problem might be with a detectorator.
So it sounds like a software issue to me. Either the operating system or whatever software you're using to burn the CD. What software are you using to burn the CD? Are you just using Windows built-in?
Well, it's not even seeing
It's not seeing the drive.
Oh, it's not even seeing the drive. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and that's what makes it really unusual.
Can you test... I suppose... I imagine if you tested a brand new CD-ROM drive on another computer,
it would work just fine. Yeah, completely different drive and a completely different method of connection. Yeah. So, and if it's not seeing it, the problem is software-based.
Yeah, something might be...
Beyond there, I don't know if we can diagnose this over the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably something... It might have something to do with the registry, or it might have something to do with drivers and you not being able to install the proper drivers for some other reason, perhaps?
Unless the new external drive isn't working either. Can you try that drive with another computer? And does it work?
Right.
Yeah, if you can get that drive to work with another computer, then you know that the issue is software.
Properly. Yeah, it does work on other computers.
Yeah. Okay. You may be... scheduled for backing up your system of all the data you want and then reinstalling the operating system.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like fun, huh?
Oh, boy. Fun. Oh, yeah. Joy.
It's the kind of things that we geeks do for fun, but...
I don't anymore. I've had enough of that.
Really? So you're not running Lion?
I'm running Snow Leopard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm not reinstalling. I upgraded.
Okay.
And, no. Here's the flaw in your logic. I did have to reinstall from scratch, but I didn't enjoy it.
Oh, no.
No, it just means you're not a true geek. It's not a flaw in my logic. Real geeks enjoy reinstalling their operating system. But for the rest of you, I'm really sorry. Sorry to hear that you're running into that problem. It sounds like you did everything that you were supposed to do, and now you're going to have to... either get some help or just dig down in the trenches and look at some websites on how to work through this.
Could it possibly be the hard drive? Not the hard drive, but the motherboard itself? Could something on that stop working?
I was thinking about that if you were connecting up another drive to that motherboard, but because you're connecting up to USB, the chances of it failing on two different interfaces, in other words, one being either SATA or IDE and the other one being USB, is vanishingly slim.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll reinstall the drive, the whole software system. Nope. I'll do it.
Yeah, just have backups ahead of time. Make sure you have everything that you have and make sure you have your installed disks ready before you start.
The other thing, back up your hard drive in two places if at all possible. Because, it's no fun to back up in one place and then your backup, something happens to it, it falls off the table or something.
Yes, I will do that.
Not that we're paranoid or anything. All right, take care. Best of luck to you.
Bye-bye now.
Wow, that's a shame that people are having so many problems so recently.
Guess it's life, huh? Technology. Psh. whatever.
It's made by meat people.
Yeah, we. Yeah, exactly. All these darn meat puppets.
Yeah.
But on the bright side, we still have some news. And I'm going to cover this one just because it's so much fun. Global warming.
That sounds like fun.
Yes.
I just perked up.
Global warming. Yeah. Prominent scientist from NASA, James Hansen, who we've talked about before on the show. Wish he would come on the show, but haven't been able to get him on as yet.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
The guy's busy. Yeah,
so what about this Mr. Hansen you speak of?
He has been, along with two co-authors of a paper, have been looking at recent heat waves. Heat waves like the Russian heat wave of 2010, European heat wave of 2003. And whereas we were talking, a lot of times people will say, hey, look at Hurricane Katrina. That's global warming. And you're like, it's a singular event. You can't make an overall trend from that. Mm-hmm. Or like, we have a heat wave right now across the U.S. Is that global warming? We'd have to look at historical data and look at it in context to see whether it had. Well, 2003 and 2010, you're looking at some historical context. And what they have found was that it is very likely that this is due to global warming. That when they're looking at the output of greenhouse gases and their projections from their models, if they were not there, that the temperature would not have reached the point that it did, that it has recently.
Mm-hmm.
So they can actually point to a couple of heat waves and saying, yep, it's that hot because of global warming.
Without global warming, we might have had a small heat wave, but it would not have been nearly
It would not have been a record-breaking heat wave.
That makes sense.
Can you say more about how they figured that out?
Well, with regard to climate models, the model is basically you have a computer algorithm or you have some variables go in. You have a supercomputer crunch those numbers. And then you compare that to things that have happened in the past. You put your model in and then have time go on with a certain amount of CO2 output and the like and the measurements. And does your model fit what actually happened?
So you run your model over the past, what you have data of what happened.
Right.
And then you can extrapolate using that.
And that's how you know a model.
So then when you look at the actual heat waves, it's like going to the back of the book to check your answers.
Well, yeah. It's going back and using... You have two different models. You have one that's with global warming and one without.
Uh-huh.
Or one without the greenhouse gases, without the various things that are going on, and the anthropomorphic global warming, as it stands. And
anthropogenic.
Anthropogenic, thank you. Anthropomorphic, wow, that was
for anthropomorphizing global warming.
Yes. Well, no, it's a vengeful global warming.
Yeah, global warming seems angry.
That's cuddly. Yeah, and so you basically look at these models and you see which thing fits. This is how models work, is that you're looking to see, if I predict it's going to happen this way, and this is how science works, you look and see if you find a pattern, you go, well, I predict that it's going to work this way the next time it happens. And then you see if it does. And then you go, hey, this looks like we're on the right track. Does it happen again?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, you go, there's a problem with my model. Go back to the drawing board. Let's look again. So, yeah, that's how the models are born.
What's interesting about what you just said is if it doesn't work, it doesn't mean that there isn't global warming. It means that we haven't figured it out.
Or it means that our models may not be 100% accurate.
Right. And in general, the models are not completely wrong. We've gotten good enough. We've been tracking this for long enough that the models are never just like wildly off.
Right,
it's just a question of like how far along the curve do they fit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, how severely is global warming happening?
Right, and you're always revising certain models, and you're always invalidating previous models, and looking at previous models and saying, like, oh, well, this one did work, so I'm going to give this more credence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another thing is, you can't take our models, which are general, prediction of climate over a long period of time, and say, okay, well, we're going to have a tsunami in a couple weeks. You can't get that really. Whereas you can look at, oh, we've had this many tsunamis over the last 10 years. that seems like it fits with the model.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
And the reason for that is because there are so many different molecules that things interact in chemical processes, interacting on the planet, wind patterns, heat interactions, that to model that accurately where you'd be able to say, yes, this is going to, there's going to be a tsunami at this point. Or going to be, you know, some weather, some hurricane at this point, would mean that you would need a supercomputer that had all that could take into account all of the heat variations and molecules of the Earth, which means that the computer would have to be as large or larger than the Earth.
We can't even model a single-celled organism in real time or even remotely close. So imagine trying to model the entire, the entire Earth or whatever. Anyway, kind of crazy.
We had someone looking at us in the air room, and now she's being very shy and not telling us why.
Well, I saw something on Reddit the other day, and I didn't actually click on the link completely, so I don't know if I'm being completely accurate here, but there was something about a complete model of a organism.
Yes, and we covered this
from cell to cell
a couple months ago, and it is a complete, or it's a model to the point of where we understand it. There's still some gaps in our knowledge about how cell processes work, but it was not real time. It actually took like 11 hours for a single instance of mitosis a basic bacterium.
So, so not perhaps the best way to try to predict what that organism would do in the future.
Yeah, and also this is also based on many, many scientific papers. Not necessarily. Yeah, it's exactly. It's not crazy.
And oh no, we didn't get to our conversation about Mebibytes and Gibibytes.
Oh well, now that means we've got something for sure for next time.
Yeah.
Hey, GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by AFS, welcoming students from 90 countries to live with host families while attending high schools in Central California. Information about becoming a host family and public diplomacy initiative details at afsusa.org.
And GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank him for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. In the air room with me have been Bonnie Jean Primch, Ben Jaffe, whose middle name I do not know,
and
Stacey Jurgens. Thank you so much for joining us as a guest geek.
Thank you.
Bonnie, I hope we see you far more often. Ben, thank you again for being on the show.
Yo, yo.
And I have been your host, Miles Elam. And do we have any other quick little news bits we want to fit in just before the end of the show? You got 30 seconds.
So I read an interesting story about Apple, how they're doing a lot of litigation these days. And as a result of the litigation, they're having to give away some of their secrets, the way they do business. How much they spend on advertising, $100 million a year for the iPhone alone.
So the legendary secretive company has to be less secretive.
Interesting facts in that article. I'll put it up on geeksweet.org.
All right, thank you. And it's time now for Car Talk.